7%. From Apple, 97.5%. From Google Alphabet, 96%. From Facebook, 94.5%. From PayPal, 92.2%. And from Microsoft, 91.7%. Bias? What bias? We often hear the mainstream media scoffing at the idea that they are in any way politically biased. Well, a 2013 study from Indiana University's School of Journalism revealed that American journalists were nearly four times more likely to be Democrats than Republicans. While many proclaimed to be independents, one can safely presume that this was a form of impression management, even if to fool oneself about being ideologically impartial. Of note, beyond industries that deal with information, academia, journalism, social media, there are many professions wherein a political tilt has tangible repercussions. For example, physicians are likely to offer different treatments as a function of their political leanings. To further complicate matters, different medical specialties yield varying patterns of political affiliations, the most conservative of which are surgery, anesthesiology, and urology, and the most liberal being infectious disease, psychiatry, and pediatrics. Choose your psychiatrist carefully, lest your schizophrenia be blamed on climate change, an overbearing mother, or Donald Trump. I end this chapter with a very poignant quote from Ronald Reagan, uttered nearly two decades before he became president of the United States. "But freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. We didn't pass it on to our children in the bloodstream. The only way they can inherit the freedom we have known is if we fight for it, protect it, defend it, and then hand it to them with the well-taught lessons of how they, in their lifetime, must do the same. And if you and I don't do this, then you and I may well spend our sunset years telling our children and our children's children what it was once like in America, where men were free." Let us heed President Reagan's immeasurably wise words. We must renew our commitment to freedom of speech and fight against the left's idea pathogens that seek to reduce us to irrationality and ideological conformity. Chapter 4. Anti-science, anti-reason, and illiberal movements. Those who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities. Voltaire. The idea pathogens on university campuses fall into several large categories. Postmodernism posits that all knowledge is relative, no objective truths, while generating obscure and impenetrable prose that is tantamount to random gibberish. This anti-science buffoonery generates positions such as the "science must fall" movement that demands that people, quote, decolonize their minds from, quote, racist Western science. Social constructivism proposes that the great majority of human behaviors, desires, and preferences are formed not by human nature or our biological heritage, but by society, which means, among other things, that there are no biologically determined sex differences, but only culturally imposed, quote, gender roles. Radical feminism asserts that these gender roles are due to the nebulous and nefarious forces of the patriarchy. Transgender activism purports that biological sex and gender are non-binary fluid constructs. Scientifically speaking, postmodernism, social constructivism, radical feminism, and transgender activism are all based on demonstrable falsehoods. But when one's ideological commitments are paramount, the rejection of scientific facts becomes the necessary collateral damage. Freedom from reality. Many idea pathogens share one common thread: a deep desire to liberate people from the shackles of reality. Take, for example, the blank slate premise of the human mind. It posits that humans are born void of any evolved biological blueprints and innate individual differences. Our eventual life trajectories are thought to be fully shaped by the distinct environments to which we've been exposed. This is a hopeful but delusional belief. John Watson, one of the founders of behaviorism, famously stated, "Give me a dozen healthy infants, well-formed, and my own specified world to bring them up in, and I'll guarantee to take anyone at random and train him to become any type of specialist I might select. Doctor, lawyer, artist, merchant chief, and yes, even beggar man and thief, regardless of his talents, penchants, tendencies, abilities, vocations, and race of his ancestors. I am going beyond my facts, and I admit it, but so have the advocates of the contrary, and they have been doing it for many thousands of years." This is a truly extraordinary statement. It falsely posits that your parents, or Dr. John Watson, could have nurtured you into becoming the next NBA superstar. Move aside Michael Jordan, there is a new kid in town, and he is a chubby and clumsy 5'4" teenager named Mordecai Goldberg, who has been expertly trained by John Watson. Watson rejected the notion of heredity and innate talent. Our conclusion, then, is that we have no real evidence of the inheritance of traits. Everything we have been in the habit of calling, quote, instinct today is a result largely of training, belongs to man's learned behavior. As a corollary from this, I wish to draw the conclusion that there is no such thing as an inheritance of capacity, talent, temperament, mental constitution, and characteristics. These things again depend on training that goes on mainly in the cradle. Dear parents, please rest assured that your children might become the next Lionel Messi, arguably the greatest soccer player of all time, or the next Albert Einstein, as long as you provide them with the right environments. It's a truly hopeful message, rooted in a rejection of biological science and common sense. Similarly, radical feminists refuse to concede that men and women might possess evolutionarily based distinct abilities, interests, and talents. While the average 3-year-old is aware of these self-evident truths and can tell the difference between an NFL linebacker and the diminutive pop star Ariana Grande, social constructivists reject the, quote, patriarchal notion that men and women are different. But perhaps the greatest tool for liberating oneself from the shackles of reality is the trans prefix, which magically makes your biological sex or race, as per Rachel Dolezal, a white woman who self-identifies as black, whatever you want it to be. Do not misunderstand me. There are people, fortunately very few, who truly suffer from gender dysphoria. But their existence should not lead us to reject the biological facts that irrevocably shape who we are. To elevate one's, quote, self-identity above reality is hardly liberating. It is a rejection of truth. It is perhaps not surprising, then, that postmodernism is so rampant amongst radical feminists, social constructivists, and trans activists. It is the ultimate epistemological liberator. It frees us from objective truth by celebrating, quote, my truth. Men get pregnant and women have penises. In 2002, I had a Kafkaesque chat that served as a prophetic warning sign of the lunacy that would eventually fully engulf not just university campuses, but our legislative chambers as well. One of my doctoral students had recently defended his dissertation, so we set up a celebratory dinner to mark the moment. 4 people attended the infamous dinner, my wife and I, along with my doctoral student and his date. My student had warned me that his date was a graduate student committed to postmodernism, radical feminism, and cultural anthropology, the perfect tsunami of anti-science, quote, thinking. When in mixed company, the norm is to avoid a discussion of politics and religion. And this person's beliefs were akin to a political ideology or a quasi-religious cult, so I reluctantly agreed to be on my best behavior. Surely my student knew me well enough to know that this was a tenuous promise at best. In the immortal words of Bette Davis in the classic film All About Eve, "Fasten your seatbelts, it's going to be a bumpy night." Postmodernism proclaims that there are no objective truths. Evolutionary psychologists like myself recognize that human universals exist precisely because they constitute elements of a shared biological heritage. Inevitably, my student's companion and I ended up in a debate. She scoffed at my first principles, and I scoffed at hers. So I laid out a challenge to my interlocutor. I would offer what I considered to be a human universal, and she would tell me why I was wrong. I began with what I was sure was an incontestable example. When it comes to Homo sapiens, only women bear children. She rolled her eyes at my gargantuan stupidity and told me of a Japanese tribe where men somehow, quote, spiritually, bear children. She scolded me for focusing on the material and biological realm because this was what kept women barefoot, pregnant, and in the kitchen. Apparently, my first example was too toxic and triggering, so I made a second, less, quote, controversial attempt. I proposed to her that sailors have always relied on the fact that the sun rises in the east and sets in the west, and that this was an objective universal truth. How do you think she dismantled my second example? She went into her toolbox of postmodernist bullshit and deployed a deconstructivist retort. She questioned my use of the, quote, arbitrary labels east, west, and sun. She then added that what I refer to as the sun, she might call dancing hyena. I'm not kidding. Our conversation soon sputtered out. Over the next dozen years, conversations like this started to stack up, especially regarding, quote, gender. For example, subsequent to a lecture that I delivered at Wellesley College in 2014, one student suggested to me that professors should poll students at the start of class regarding their gender identities. If language creates reality, as postulated by deconstructionists, then to misgender someone becomes an affront to that person's, quote, reality. In late September 2016, Jordan Peterson, a professor of psychology at the University of Toronto, produced a YouTube video wherein he criticized legislation in Canada, Bill C-16, that added gender identity and gender expression as protected categories under the rubric of hate crime laws. Peterson defiantly stated that he would not let the government dictate his speech when it came to gender pronouns. Needless to say, the progressive academic mob demanded that he be fired from his tenured position. After he reached out to me, I invited him on my YouTube show, The Sad Truth, to discuss the matter. In May 2017, Peterson and I both testified in front of the Canadian Senate regarding Bill C-16. In my testimony, I cited the Office of BGLTQ Student Life at Harvard University, which argued, 1, that an individual's gender identity and gender expression were subject to daily changes. Monday I'm male, Tuesday I'm female, Wednesday I'm non-binary, Thursday I'm gender neutral, and so on. And 2, that the promulgation of, quote, fixed binaries, the idea of male and female, and, quote, biological essentialism, acknowledging evolved biological realities, was, quote, transphobic misinformation that amounted to, quote, systemic violence. In my testimony, I argued that my areas of teaching and research expertise, namely the application of evolutionary psychology to the behavioral sciences, could easily be construed as violating Bill C-16. Some of the, quote, progressive senators scoffed and laughed at such a possibility, while another accused me of being pro-genocide. Hence, in the 21st century, a chaired professor who is an evolutionary behavioral scientist has to testify in front of the Canadian Senate that humans are a sexually reproducing and sexually dimorphic species composed of males and females. Lest the reader think that this is a uniquely Canadian form of lunacy, at Rocklin Academy in California, a first grader was investigated and sent to the principal's office for innocently misgendering a classmate. California lawmakers are considering passing a law that would criminalize the, quote, knowing and repeated misgendering of individuals who are receiving long-term care services. A similar law already exists in New York City and is not restricted to healthcare settings. I can assure you that the trash talking that took place on the pitch during my competitive soccer career would have resulted in 90% of the players being sent to San Quentin for, quote, hurtful language crimes. Of note, my explicit warning to the Canadian senators regarding the proverbial slippery slope has been vindicated, as we have moved from compelled speech, person A should not misgender person B, to the imposition of having to state one's own preferred gender pronouns in email signatures and on name tags. Do not think for a moment that this tsunami of lunacy has spent itself. If anything, it is gathering force. It is now being argued that men can menstruate. J.K. Rowling, the author and progressive icon, recently fell afoul of the cancel culture brigade for questioning this, quote, fact. And this, quote, truth is being taught to children as part of their sex education. In the first Democratic debate for the party's 2020 presidential nomination, Julian Castro stated that biological males, who are now transgender women, should be guaranteed abortion rights. In a subsequent tweet, Castro issued a correction. Last night I misspoke. It's trans men, trans masculine, and non-binary folks who need full access to abortion and repro healthcare. And I'm grateful to all trans and non-binary folks for their labor in guiding me on this issue. Delusional departures from reality can indeed be confusing. In any case, I tweeted, "Dear at Julian Castro, I'm a trans woman looking to conduct a cervical exam. Do you know of a good gynecologist that you might be willing to recommend?" My satire proved prophetic after the Canadian Cancer Society released an ad campaign with the photo of a trans woman, biological male, to represent a demographic group at risk for cervical cancer. Finally, Senator Elizabeth Warren proclaimed, during her attempt to win the Democratic Party nomination for president, that if she were elected president, her nominee for Secretary of Education would have to be cleared by a 9-year-old transgender child. To indulge such fantasies is not harmless. It is a war against reason itself. Postmodernism, intellectual terrorism masquerading as faux profundity. Sometimes people overestimate their understanding of complicated phenomena, which is what some scholars call the illusion of explanatory depth. A good example is how people will give greater authority to a scientific explanation that includes pictures of multicolored neuronal brain imaging patterns, even when these patterns offer little explanatory power. Postmodernism thrives in academic circles for similar reasons. Postmodernist bullshitters like Jacques Derrida, Jacques Lacan, and Michel Foucault succeeded in academia with their charlatanism because of the assumption that if something is nearly impossible to understand, it must be profound. Note that there are individual differences in the extent to which people are swayed by bullshit. In a conversation with the American philosopher John Searle, Foucault confessed to this faux profundity. In France, you gotta have 10% incomprehensible. Otherwise, people won't think it's deep. They won't think you're a profound thinker. That admission notwithstanding, Foucault thought that Derrida pushed this strategy too far by engaging in obscurantisme terroriste. I, too, independently have referred to postmodernism as intellectual terrorism. Beware of those trying to impress you with confusing word salads. The art world is particularly susceptible to postmodernist gibberish because it is a domain where objective metrics of excellence are difficult to establish. Once you use the magic wand of subjectivity, you are able to find the supposed beauty of invisible art. Back in 1996, I visited the Carnegie Museum in Pittsburgh. As I strolled through the exhibits, I came across a blank canvas displayed as art. Notwithstanding the fact that I understood the postmodern twist to this, quote, artwork, I asked a museum representative to justify the existence of a blank, quote, painting. She explained that our discussion of the piece was testimony to its value. London's Hayward Gallery hosted an exhibition in 2012 titled Invisible, Art About the Unseen, 1957 to 2012, which featured, well, you guessed it, invisible art. Ralph Rogoff, the director of the Hayward Gallery, reiterated the importance of using one's imagination when viewing invisible pieces. With that in mind, perhaps I'll try to write an invisible manuscript for my next book project. I'll provide a front and back cover with 300 empty pages. I'll leave it to the reader's rich imagination to fill in the contents. Actually, a clever American podcaster and commentator named Michael J. Knowles beat me to it with a book titled Reasons to Vote for Democrats. The Grievance Studies Project. In 1996, Alan Sokol, a physics professor at New York University, published a gibberish article titled Transgressing the Boundaries Toward a Transformative Hermeneutics of Quantum Gravity in Social Text, a leading academic journal of postmodernism. The paper was a hoax meant to demonstrate how obscurantist gibberish prose could be published as long as it seemed to be supportive of postmodernist, quote, thinking. The editors of the journal were undoubtedly keen to publish a postmodern analysis of gravity authored by a physicist. This would grant a scientific imprimatur to their edifices of nonsense. If you thought the parody had a devastating effect on the discipline, you'd be wrong. Since postmodernism purports that reality is subjective, one person's parody is another's goldmine of meaning. With this epistemological sleight of hand, postmodernists are able to extract meaning from the most meaningless of texts. Voila, postmodernism is akin to the Hydra in Greek mythology. Cut off one of its heads, and several new ones will grow. On a personal note, I contacted Sokol in 2010 to alert him about an article that I had published in my Psychology Today column referencing his brilliant hoax. He politely pointed out that my characterization of his prose as, quote, containing pseudo-randomly generated passages was incorrect. He had assiduously toiled over the choice of every word of his hoax article. There was indeed a method to the madness. In 2017, James Lindsay and Peter Boghossian, who happens to be a good friend of mine, published a hoax paper, using pseudonyms, wherein they argued that the human penis was a conceptual construct that was a driving force behind climate change. I challenged the readers to go through the paper in question without bursting into uncontrollable laughter. I tried to do so on camera, but failed. Once the hoax was publicized, an associate editorial director put out a statement that explained, two reviewers agreed to review the paper, and it was accepted with no changes by one reviewer and with minor amends by the other. On investigation, although the two reviewers had relevant research interests, their expertise did not fully align with this subject matter, and we do not believe that they were the right choice to review this paper. Apparently, had the proper experts been used to review an utterly nonsensical paper that linked human penises to climate change, the outcome might have been different. I am unaware of any experts in phallic-based climatology, but perhaps I did not look hard enough. Detractors of the penis climate change hoax paper argued that this was hardly convincing, given that the journal that accepted the paper, Cogent Social Sciences, was a pay-to-publish predatory outlet possessing little, if any, academic prestige. Fair enough. But the perpetrators of the hoax had a nuclear option as a rebuttal. They joined forces with Helen Pluckrose, an editor with Aereo magazine, and proceeded to pull off arguably the grandest of Sokol-type projects. They wrote 20 nonsensical papers and submitted them to various leading academic journals to gauge what would happen. In Table 1 of the PDF that accompanies this audiobook, I list the titles of papers that were accepted before the trio decided to pull the plug on the project and come clean, as they were about to be found out. The articles were a hysterically funny mishmash of gibberish, but leading journals of feminist philosophy, gender studies, and associated nonsense thought these worthy of publication. I tried to cover this brilliant grand ruse on my channel while keeping a straight face. I failed. To give the reader a sense of how nonsensical these papers were, the first listed paper in Table 1 examines rape culture in dog parks via the use of black feminist criminology, while the third one involves a rewriting of Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf using feminist buzzwords, It is difficult to overestimate the extent of the nonsensical lunacy. Peter Boghossian, the only one of the three collaborators working at a university, was investigated by his institution for ethical breaches. Rather than lauding his intellectual courage for serving as a whistleblower to fraudulent disciplines, his university was looking for ways to punish him. Life is about navigating a maze of opportunity costs. If you're going to spend years studying in university, spending your parents' hard-earned money on exorbitant tuition fees, perhaps you should refrain from studying critical race theory, intersectional feminism, queer theory, and postmodernism. Avoid topics that are firmly rooted in a desire to liberate students from the shackles of reality. Table 1. The 7 Accepted Grievance Studies Papers. Titles of Papers, Journals. 1. Title of Paper: Human Reactions to Rape Culture and Queer Performativity in Urban Dog Parks in Portland, Oregon. Journal: Gender, Place, and Culture. Title of Paper: Going In Through the Back Door: Challenging Straight Male Homohysteria and Transphobia Through Receptive Penetrative Sex Toy Use. Journal: Sexuality and Culture. Title of Paper: Our Struggle is My Struggle: Solidarity Feminism as an Intersectional Reply to Neoliberal and Choice Feminism. Journal: Aphilia, Journal of Women and Social Work. Title of Paper: Who Are They to Judge? Overcoming Anthropometry and a Framework for Fat Bodybuilding. Journal: Fat Studies. Title of Paper: When the Joke is on You: A Feminist Perspective on How Positionality Influences Satire. Journal: Hypatia. Title of Paper: An Ethnography of Restaurant Masculinity: Themes of Objectification, Sexual Conquest, Male Control, and Masculine Toughness in a Sexually Objectifying Restaurant. Journal: Sex Roles. Title of Paper: Moon Meetings and the Meaning of Sisterhood: A Poetic Portrayal of Lived Feminist Spirituality. Journal: The Journal of Poetry Therapy. Trans Activism: The Tyranny of the Minority. Rachel McKinnon, a biological male who self-identifies as a woman, won the 2018 UCI Masters Track Cycling World Championships, 35 to 44 age category. Subsequent to her victory, I invited Dr. McKinnon via Twitter to appear on my show. Dear Dr. @RachelVMcKinnon, I appreciate your desire to fight for fairness when it comes to transgender rights. Do you think, though, that the biological women who lost against you have a right to feel aggrieved when a biological male beats them in a women's competition? Or do you think that the behavioral, anatomical, physiological, morphological, and hormonal advantages that men possess over women in such competitions are mere social constructions imposed by the transphobic patriarchy? I'd be happy to chat with you on my show, The Sod Truth. Care to guess what the response was? Did Dr. McKinnon take the opportunity to use my large platform to defend her positions? After all, as a professor of philosophy, she should have jumped at the opportunity to debate me on the matter. Instead, she blocked me and started name-calling everyone who questioned her victory. Apparently, Dr. McKinnon could not contemplate how outlandishly unfair her victory was to the actual women who lost to a biological male. This is precisely what I referred to as the tyranny of the minority in my Canadian Senate address in 2017. The victimology narrative means that transgender rights supersede women's rights. As a response to McKinnon's, quote, heroic victory, I released a clip on my YouTube channel satirizing this sheer insanity. Using the concepts of trans-ageism and trans-gravity, I made these up, but they are my truth, so you cannot critique me, I announced that I would be entering a judo contest in the U8 category, since I self-identify as a child who is under 8 years old. Then, using the logic from the Office of BLGTQ Student Life at Harvard University that one's gender identity is subject to daily fluctuations, I declared that I would also be entering the octogenarian judo competition, as my age self-identity changes on a daily basis. Finally, since biological sex, gender, race, and age are mere social constructs, I argued that one's weight is also a social construct, subject to the liberating powers of the trans prefix. Hence, while I might technically be over 200 pounds, I self-identify as being less than 120 pounds, but particularly so on the days that I self-identify as an octogenarian, and as such, I'd be competing against skinny elderly people. As has happened on numerous occasions, my satire proved to be prophetic when less than 3 weeks later, the news broke that Emile Ratelband, a 69-year-old Dutchman, was seeking to legally change his age to 49, as this would grant him greater advantages on the labor and mating markets, among other things. As I have often remarked on social media, my sarcasm and satire are sharper than a surgeon's scalpel in slicing through entrenched deposits of nonsensical bullshit. However, it is often missed even by otherwise sophisticated individuals. During a recent medical checkup, my physician pulled up a few of my tweets where I lamented my status as a differently weighted individual. He was apparently concerned about my mental and emotional stability, as he had utterly missed the sarcasm. Here is one of the tweets. What gives the right of my physician to use antiquated notions of weight to determine that I need to lose weight? Real scientists now know that a given weight scale reading is not fixed, but rather fluid. Plus, what about those who wish to be weightless? Don't they have rights? The gods of victimhood recently offered a test case of competitive intersectionality. In Windsor, Ontario, a trans woman filed a human rights complaint against a spa that refused to provide her with waxing services. The wax artist, a Muslim woman, was understandably reticent to wax a biological male. It was a fascinating case of victimology poker. Who holds the highest hand, the Muslim woman or the trans woman? Only expert judges in oppression Olympics could adjudicate such a case. Another trans woman has filed 15 complaints in British Columbia against spas that refuse to perform a Brazilian wax on her. An even more galling case pitted the Vancouver Rape Relief and Women's Shelter against trans activists. Municipal funding to the shelter was halted because of its refusal to admit trans women. Since 1973, the shelter has granted support to 46,000 women, but apparently the well-being of innumerable female victims seeking to escape horrifying situations is secondary to granting, quote, inclusion rights to trans women, who constitute an astonishingly small percentage of the Canadian population. All Canadians are equal, but some are more equal than others. Sid Ziegler is an LGBTQ activist and founder of the National Gay Flag Football League. In February 2019, he appeared on Fox News and said there was no scientific evidence that trans athletes might possess any competitive advantages. I asked him the following question in a tweet. Dear @SidZiegler, I'm currently watching you on @FoxNews. Do you not think that trans women, biological males, exhibit physiological, anatomical, morphological, and hormonal differences as compared to biological females? As an evolutionary behavioral scientist who has researched evolutionary-based sex differences, I was under the impression that sex differences exist. Perhaps you'd like to come on my show and educate me. While he did accept my invitation, things quickly deteriorated. I wanted to gauge whether a conversation would be productive, and to do so, I sought to establish whether Ziegler was connected to reality, let alone to banal scientific truths, or whether he was merely a dogged activist. I privately asked him his thoughts on a tweet that Pink News had posted that day. Trans women are women, so trans women's bodies are women's bodies. So trans women's penises are women's penises. Ziegler was unhappy with my question. Shortly thereafter, I publicly tagged him on Twitter regarding two trans women, biological males, who had finished first and second in the Connecticut Girls High School track and field competition. This was specifically relating to his original claim on Fox News that trans athletes did not possess any competitive advantages. This is when his activist colors came into full view. He accused me of being a transphobic culture warrior masquerading as a scientist, and accordingly it was beneath him to interact with me. Not one to take personal insults lightly, I went after him repeatedly on Twitter and declared him president of Unicornia. Needless to say, he blocked me on Twitter. Such is the reality of trying to engage people who reject biological realities that are as obvious as the existence of gravity. Lisa Littman is a physician and an assistant professor of the practice of behavioral and social sciences at Brown University. In 2018, she published a paper in PLOS ONE, wherein she argued that rapid onset gender dysphoria spreads in social networks as a form of contagion fueled in part by peer pressure. Brown University had originally issued a news release describing the study's conclusions, but then, when faced with an outcry from transgender activists who thought that the article's conclusions were offensive, expunged the story from its website. As an act of solidarity toward an embattled colleague, I reached out to Littman and invited her on my show. She was reluctant to accept my invitation, as she was undoubtedly concerned about possible institutional repercussions that might befall her. This was yet again a case where faux outrage trumps academic freedom. If people scream, "I'm offended," loudly enough, they drive the academic discourse. I recently engaged the Oscar-winning actress Charlize Theron on Twitter. In my view, Theron and many other parents of newly trans children are exhibiting a classic manifestation of Munchausen syndrome by proxy, via contagion. They can reap the woke, progressive rewards of being the parent of a trans child. Theron has proclaimed that one of her two adopted children, a biological boy, is transgendered, having advised her at the age of 3 that he is a girl. Accordingly, Theron is raising the child as a girl, since apparently it is not up to her, or to biological science, to decide the gender identity of her child. Some of my relevant tweets included, "So brave, so stunning, so progressive, well done at Charlize Africa. I raised my children as non-arboreal, multicellular carbon-based agents. I did not impose a species on them. It's for them to decide whether they wish to be part of Homo sapiens or not." I continued with, "I'm following the lead of the parental heroism of at Charlize Africa. I've advised my non-arboreal, multicellular, carbon-based agents, children, that they do not need to call my wife and I mom and dad, respectively. We are gender-neutral, non-binary caregivers 1 and 2. And I finished off with the introduction of a new concept, periodic table fluidity. I don't want my children to be restricted to viewing themselves as carbon-based. This is why I'm now immersing them in the fluidity of the periodic table. I've asked them to look at all elements and decide which ones they self-identify with in terms of their building blocks. My satire is not meant to denigrate the very real and very rare condition of gender dysphoria. However, I do recognize the statistical improbability of the number of parents who are now coming out as parents of trans children. Children are meant to be protected and cherished in the privacy of a family. They are not meant to be virtue-signaling social justice pawns for impressing progressive friends. Progressivism itself is a cognitively inconsistent and axiomatically irrational belief system. Let us examine how age becomes a fluid marker of one's cognitive abilities as a function of ideological expediency. If an individual commits a premeditated, heinous murder at the age of 17 years and 364 days, the progressives would be the first to proclaim that he should be tried in juvenile court. After all, he is a, quote, child who cannot fully comprehend the consequences of his actions. He is apparently too impulsive to make sound judgments, given that his prefrontal cortex is yet to be fully developed. The brains of adolescents continue to develop well into their 20s, and as such, to punish an adolescent murderer is, quote, cruel and hardly progressive. On the other hand, when it comes to the age at which individuals should be allowed to vote in national elections, many progressive Democrats, including House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, support the idea of reducing the age to 16. When it comes to enlisting in the United States military and being shipped off to foreign lands to kill bad guys, one's prefrontal cortex apparently becomes sufficiently developed at the age of 17. However, according to many progressive parents, including Charlize Theron, a 3-year-old has the necessary cognitive and emotional maturity to make a definitive pronouncement about gender identity. Jean Piaget, a historic figure in developmental psychology, is undoubtedly rolling in his grave. Unlike Piaget, whose pioneering work delineated clear stages of cognitive development that apply across children, progressives are very fluid about how age affects our ability to think, feel, and act, which is why we are forbidden to criticize the arrogantly sanctimonious, if not pathologically hysteric, 17-year-old Swedish environmental activist Greta Thunberg, who is trying to save us from our evil ways. In the land of progressive unicornia, science is only valuable if it is consistent with ideological dogma. Otherwise, it is nothing more than bigoted hate facts. In a recent case in Florida, a biologically female middle school student who self-identifies as male was allowed entry to the boys' locker room without the male students or their parents having a say in the matter. One male teacher refused to monitor the locker room in the presence of the trans individual, as he did not feel it appropriate to view a naked young biologically female student. Is the teacher being transphobic? Do the boys have a right to refuse to undress in front of a biological girl? Or would that be an example of transphobia? Is it not illiberal to trample the rights of everyone in order to accommodate the trans student? This is yet another manifestation of the tyranny of the minority. Celebrate and accommodate my self-identity, which conflicts with biological reality, or else risk the wrath of the progressive police and possibly institutional, if not legal, repercussions. The wacky world of academic feminism. Feminism, throughout its history, has ameliorated the lives of innumerable women around the world. But, like any ideology or institution, it seeks to perpetuate itself. And that now requires maintaining a manufactured victimhood narrative. How to achieve this perpetual victimhood nirvana? The Ambivalent Sexism Inventory, ASI, offers the solution. It is a psychometric scale consisting of 22 items that measures hostile sexism, 11 items, and benevolent sexism, 11 items. The former refers to such unacceptable forms of sexism as sexual harassment or paying women lesser wages than men for the same job. But it might surprise you to learn that if men idolize women, place them on a pedestal, proclaim that their lives are incomplete without them, and seek to protect them, they are vile, benevolent sexists. The 11 statements used to measure benevolent sexism are reproduced below. Respondents are asked to rate each statement using a 6-point disagree strongly to agree strongly scale. Items 3, 6, and 13 are reverse-coded to ensure that respondents are paying attention to the task and are accordingly being consistent in their answers. 1. No matter how accomplished he is, a man is not truly complete as a person unless he has the love of a woman. 3. In a disaster, women ought not necessarily to be rescued before men. 6. People are often truly happy in life without being romantically involved with a member of the other sex. 8. Many women have a quality of purity that few men possess. 9. Women should be cherished and protected by men. 12. Every man ought to have a woman whom he adores. 13. Men are complete without women. 17. A good woman should be set on a pedestal by her man. 19. Women, compared to men, tend to have a superior moral sensibility. 20. Men should be willing to sacrifice their own well-being in order to provide financially for the women in their lives. 22. Women, as compared to men, tend to have a more refined sense of culture and good taste. Humans are a sexually reproducing species, and one of the most fundamental human drives is to find a mate and form a meaningful union with a member of the opposite sex. But according to the ASI, a man who admits to such a drive is succumbing to benevolent sexism. It does not take a sophisticated evolutionary psychologist to understand the utter lunacy of such a stance. Note also that any man who seeks to protect and cherish women is a vile sexist. It is perhaps not surprising, then, that a recent study found that people are less likely to perform life-saving CPR on women. Apparently, 4 decades of feminist brainwashing and witch hunts have taught men too well. It is better to be a, quote, non-sexist, cowardly bystander than a, quote, sexist hero. Someone should advise women to stop fantasizing about courageous firefighters and heroic uniformed soldiers. There is a new sheriff in town who epitomizes a progressive definition of masculinity, apathetic, cowardly bystander man. Incidentally, there is an extraordinary cognitive inconsistency inherent here. Men are repeatedly lectured about stepping up to serve as allies to women in the workplace, but if they do so, they are engaging in benevolent sexism. All roads lead to sexism. Of the many dreadful anti-science idea pathogens to spring from the delusional world of gender studies, few are as corrosive as the nonsensical concept of toxic masculinity. Nearly 20 years ago, Christina Hoff Sommers authored an important book on the unrelenting attack on boys. The problem has only worsened since. It is perhaps not a good idea to pathologize half of humanity when dealing with a sexually reproducing species. Countless prestigious universities now offer talks, seminars, if not full courses on how to unlearn, combat, and overcome toxic masculinity. My alma mater, Cornell University, hosted a talk on the use of fashion to combat toxic masculinity, whereas Lehigh University created a men's therapeutic cuddle group to combat the scourge of this dreadful, quote, pathology. A professor of education has recently suggested that children as young as kindergarten students should be taught how to combat toxic masculinity. Ideologues are always keen on infecting young children with their idea pathogens, as this is the most opportune time for the brainwashing process to begin. Radical feminism is indeed a spreading virus. What is toxic masculinity? Well, it is apparently the undesirable elements of being male. This might include being hyper-competitive in sports, exhibiting social or physical dominance, or refraining from being too emotional in public. Toxic masculinity is ascribed as the culprit of innumerable social ills, including violence, war, and sexual assault. If only we could detoxify men to retain the good components of their masculinity, as the Gillette Company recently implored all toxic men to do via a breathtakingly condescending and insulting ad, then the world would be a better place. It is important to note, though, that toxic masculinity is not restricted to the stereotypically brawny, hypermasculine types. One should also be wary of toxic geek masculinity, as exemplified by the male characters on the television show The Big Bang Theory. Note that both hypermasculine Navy SEALs and beta geeks who belong to the Logarithms Are Cool Club are manifestations of toxic masculinity. All roads lead to toxic masculinity, including your preferred diet. Veganism promotes white masculinity, but meat eating is an instantiation of potentially toxic, hegemonic masculinity. To be on the safe side, I recommend that men restrict their diets to eating eggs and cheese. The only prospective problem, though, is that most eggshells and cheeses are white, so this diet may be a subtle manifestation of internalized white supremacy. I truly see only one solution here. Men must engage in collective fasting until death visits them, which would directly help reduce toxic masculinity. Dear men, if you truly wish to serve as allies to women, collective suicide, or perhaps collective castration, should be seriously considered. Many academic feminists are unhappy with the delineation of toxic masculinity from masculinity in general. Their position, a rather common one in women's studies programs, is that masculinity is inherently, quote, problematic. No need for the toxic qualifier. Lisa Wade, a feminist and sociology professor at Occidental College, explained, "Trump's masculinity is what we call a toxic masculinity. In the pre-Trump era, The modifier was used to differentiate bad masculine ideals from good ones. Toxic masculinities, some claimed, were behind sexual assault, mass shootings, and the weird thing where men refused to wear sunscreen, but they didn't reflect masculinity generally, so one had to leave that idea alone. But we can only give masculinity so many modifiers for so long before we have to confront the possibility that it is masculinity itself that has become the problem. Since being male is inherently bad, it is perhaps not surprising that Susanna Danuta Walters, a professor of sociology, director of the Women's, Gender, and Sexuality Studies Program at Northeastern University, and editor of the gender studies journal Signs, penned an article in the Washington Post titled, "Why Can't We Hate Men?" It concluded, "So men, if you really are hashtag with us and would like us to not hate you for all the millennia of woe you have produced and benefited from, start with this. Lean out so we can actually just stand up without being beaten down. Pledge to vote for feminist women only. Don't run for office. Don't be in charge of anything. Step away from the power. We got this. And please know that your crocodile tears won't be wiped away by us anymore. We have every right to hate you. You have done us wrong. Hashtag because patriarchy. It is long past time to play hard for team feminism. And win." In 1998, Hillary Clinton said at the Conference on Domestic Violence in El Salvador that women have always been the primary victims of war. Women lose their husbands, their fathers, their sons in combat. One might think that since, historically, men are the ones who have died in the millions, often for such noble causes as defending their countries, their homes, and their families, that they might be the primary victims of war. But no, women are always the victims. Gender studies programs are founded on the "I am a victim, therefore I am" ethos. All roads lead to victimhood. As many feminist academics and female politicians have proclaimed, the future is female indeed. In case you thought that academic feminism was restricted to the delusional and conspiratorial world of gender studies, let me disabuse you of that notion. Science itself can apparently be illuminated by the unique lens of feminist epistemology. Fields that you might have thought were immune from this nonsense have all been slowly infected with this idea pathogen. We now have feminist architecture, feminist biology, feminist physics, feminist chemistry, feminist geography, feminist mathematics, and feminist glaciology. This next sentence comes from the abstract of the paper on feminist glaciology. "Merging feminist postcolonial science studies and feminist political ecology, the feminist glaciology framework generates robust analysis of gender, power, and epistemologies in dynamic socio-ecological systems, thereby leading to more just and equitable science and human-ice interactions." Who knew that ice could be so sexist and patriarchal? Nearly 125 years ago, the feminist Charlotte Perkins Gilman infamously proclaimed, "There is no female mind. The brain is not an organ of sex. As well speak of a female liver." One would have thought that the thousands of scientific studies documenting the biological, anatomical, physiological, morphological, hormonal, cognitive, emotional, and behavioral differences between the two sexes might have put a dent in those obstinate refusals to accept the existence of biologically based sex differences. To use an old aphorism, the more things change, the more they remain the same. The latest instantiation of this lunacy is packaged as neurosexism. It is apparently sexist to demonstrate that men and women exhibit neuroanatomical differences. Instead, flat earthers of the human mind and other deniers of reality point to some neuroscientific studies that have yielded similarities across the two sexes on some brain metrics such as the thickness of a specific cortical area, and voila, male and female brains become indistinguishable. This is logically equivalent to arguing that since men and women each have 10 fingers, 10 toes, 2 eyes, and 2 kidneys, they are indistinguishable beings. Along the same lines, since the Great Dane, largest dog breed, and the Chihuahua, smallest dog breed, both have two eyes, one tail, four legs, and two ears, they are indistinguishable. I recently announced on my YouTube channel that my family would be adopting a giraffe, since we are unable to distinguish it from a dog, as both have a tail, two eyes, and teeth, among many other morphological similarities. They must be the same species. The reality is that there are innumerable neuroanatomical sex differences that have been documented in the literature. That said, even when a specific anatomical trait is the same across the two sexes, this does not imply that its functionality is the same, because brain structures interact with hormones in sex-specific ways. What is particularly galling is that neurosexism was positively covered in Nature, one of the most prestigious scientific journals. No platform is safe from idea pathogens, especially when they are being propagated by individuals willing to sacrifice truth in the service of their pet ideologies. Radical feminists are staunch supporters of the diversity, inclusion, and equity cult when it suits them, but they are silent on the bewildering lack of gender parity in women's studies departments. I suppose that one would not want to damage the, quote, important scholarly work conducted in such departments with an infusion of toxic masculinity. Radical feminists do not complain that men constitute the overwhelming majority when it comes to occupational deaths, nor do they bat an eye at the fact that men are much more likely to commit suicide, be the victim of a murder, be incarcerated, be homeless, and have a much lower life expectancy. These global realities are undoubtedly due to their toxic masculinity, but the radical feminists are very keen to promulgate the illusory gender gap in salaries, even though this canard has been refuted on innumerable occasions. The Women's World Cup in soccer recently took place in France. The U.S. women's national team, who won the tournament, trashed lowly Thailand 13-0 in the group stage. The success of the team triggered the ire of a broad range of social justice warriors, all of whom demanded equal pay for female soccer players.